to the clerk. Her mouth was opened unattractively as she stared up at the ceiling. "You don't get paid enough to deal with this," I told her firmly. I didn't borrow authority from Adam for fear that it would worry him, but I know how it sounds and can imitate it when I have to. "She's gone and won't be back." I looked around, and except for a dent in the drywall where her knee had hit the wall, there wasn't any extra damage. There was blood all over, but I was betting that Walmart had cleaners to get all sorts of things out of their carpets. I grabbed the jeans I wanted, as well as the t-shirts. I put the darkest t-shirt up to wipe my nose. It hadn't been a hard hit, and it had mostly stopped bleeding. "I'll just go pay for this," I said. "You can put those other jeans back where they go, then call someone in to clean up." I walked out like I knew what I was doing and paid for the clothes with cash, so there was no awkward name left behind at the scene of the crime thing. The clerk was too occupied looking at my split lip to notice that one of the shirts was bloody. As I took the receipt, I noticed a general migration toward the changing room on the part of the employees. At least one of them looked old enough to be a person of authority. I smiled at the clerk and tried to look innocent, grab my bags, and make a quick getaway. "Honey," said the cashier, who was half my age, "you get rid of that man. You don't have to put up with being a punching bag." "It was a woman," I told her, "and you are absolutely right." I walked briskly out of the store and kept going across the parking lot as I called Adam. "I saw a sandwich shop in the little mall above Walmart," I told him. "I'll meet you there."
"It's a little early for lunch," he said.
We'd eaten breakfast just before he dropped me off at Walmart. "You're a wolf," I informed him. "You can eat any time."
"What did you do?"
I heard a siren and hoped that it wasn't someone coming looking for me. I made my brisk walk a little brisker. "Got in a fight with my girlfriend, apparently." I hung up before he could ask me anything else. The nice lady at the sandwich shop had been happy to fill a plastic bag with ice and accepted my story about a jealous girlfriend with a sympathetic ear. I kept my wedding ring hidden. She made me two large chicken sandwiches, and I paid for them and a pair of juices. When Adam drove up, I was watching the police cars at Walmart. It must have been a slow day, with the ice bag wrapped in my new blood-stained black t-shirt. Bloodstains on a new black shirt were more a matter of texture and smell than color. "I think we ought to go back to the camp," I told him. He pulled the ice down from my eye and took a good look before he let me put it back up again. Then he examined my hands and brought my free hand up to his lips so he could kiss the bruises. He led me to the truck and buckled me in. It was a good thing that there weren't many cars in the parking lot, or he'd never have gotten the big truck back out of it. I never had that problem with my rabbit. He didn't say anything, just drove the quarter of a mile toward the highway on-ramp in silence. I made it mostly to the Dalles before I broke. "I didn't know anyone wanted to kill me when I made you leave me alone."
"I smelled Faye," he said neutrally, the sneak. That was why he'd kissed my knuckles.
"She jumped me in the changing room," I told him reluctantly. I'd known after the doorknob hit my eye that I wasn't going to be able to hide the fight from Adam. Not that I'd really been planning on keeping the attack secret. It had just been an option I'd wanted to keep open if I could. "I think it was one of the Otterkin, and she was the weird lady from lunch the day before yesterday."
"Did you leave the body?" he asked.
"No body," I told him. "I wasn't trying to kill her, and once I got rid of the knife, I was pretty sure she couldn't kill me. She wasn't any stronger than a normal human." I thought a moment. "I don't think so, anyway. As soon as the clerk came in, she glamoured back to Otterkin and left through the ceiling. She might have used magic to get up there, but otters are pretty agile." He squeezed his nose. Then he laughed.
"I guess you proved your point," he told me. "You can take care of yourself."
"I wonder why the Otterkin are trying to kill me," I said.
"I don't think that we'll call in the Fae to help us against the River Devil," said Adam. "I think the chances are that they may come down on the wrong side."
"You were thinking of asking the Fae for help?" I squeaked. Help was even worse than a favor. He gave me an exasperated look.
"I said I wasn't."
"It sounded like you might have been before I was attacked."
"You're trying to distract me," he said. "You don't need to. I'm not going to yell at you because you were attacked, especially since you won the fight."
"She ran away," I said.
without accomplishing her purpose. That's losing in my book, especially since you got rid of her knife before she stuck it in you.
I gave him a wary look, but he honestly didn't appear upset.
Mercy, he said, in a fair fight between near equals, I'll back you every time. It's the demons, vampires, and river devils I worry about. And I'm working on that.
I could live with that. If he could. Chapter 10. Unlike the Maryhill Museum or She Who Watches, Stonehenge was a place I had been to many times over the years. It's right on the way to my mom's house in Portland. Sam Hill had been told that the henge at Salisbury had been used for human sacrifice, and decided that it was a fitting memorial for the men who were sacrificed in World War I. Adam and I parked the truck next to a deserted orchard down by the river and walked over hill and dale to the high place where Sam Hill's conceit looked out over the gorge. I never could decide if Stonehenge was beautiful, spiritual, or merely a roadside oddity. Certainly it was impressive. A massive, exact-sized replica cast in concrete of a place half a world away. The original Stonehenge took about 1,600 years to build. The one at Maryhill took a little more than 10 years to complete. It is a monument to commemorate 13 young men at Klickitat County who died in a war nearly 100 years ago, a silent testament of a man who knew how to dream big and, I'd been told, a magical collection site of great power to those who knew how to access it. I'd always taken that last bit with a grain of salt. After all, I'd have thought a powerful place would have attracted witches or something nastier. And there is not a whole lot nastier than a black witch. And in all the years I'd been visiting, I'd never seen anything dangerous. The other reason I doubted was because I am pretty good at sensing magic, and it had never felt any more magical than my garage. In the night, it was different. The minute my foot landed on the flattened area around the monument, I could feel the pulse of magic under my feet. Adam sensed it too. The werewolves don't usually feel magic other than their own. He lifted his head and took a deep breath. I thought this was an awfully public place to be meeting, I told Adam. You can see up here from all the way over the river on the main highway. Suddenly, though, Coyote's desire to meet here makes better sense. I've heard talk of ley lines since before I could walk. Bran might be a werewolf, but he understands the working of magic even if he doesn't do witchcraft or wizardry himself. I paused, frowning. I don't think he does, anyway. I've been here a lot over the years, and this is the first time I've ever felt magic.
Ley lines, said Adam. I can feel something.
He closed his eyes and breathed in, as if trying to pick up that little bit more that isolating his senses might give him.
Ley lines, huh? Feels like someone's stroking my hair in the wrong direction.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing? I asked. He snorted.
No flirting. We're here on business.
We'd come early. My husband, the eternal tactician, had determined that would be the better course. I like those two words together, my and husband.
What are you grinning about? He asked.
I told him, and he grinned too.
Hopeless, he said. You are hopeless. We are supposed to be getting the lay of the land, not making goo-goo eyes at each other. I suppose it won't do much harm, though, since it has already been scouted.
He tucked his arm around me and nodded toward the tall stone outer ring of Stonehenge, where a pair of hawks perched, watching us. Ah, I said, but are they enemy scouts or friendly ones?
Friendly, said Jim Alvin, coming out of the shadows like, well, like a good Indian scout. Hank found that as a hawk he can better resist the river devil. So he thought it would be safer for everyone if he stayed in his feathered form.
It takes a lot to sneak up on a coyote, upwind, silent, and cloaked by darkness and stillness. From Adam's expressionless face, I knew he hadn't sensed Jim either. I reached up and tipped an imaginary hat to him. Are all medicine men as adept at sneaking around as you are? I asked. In one of those coincidences that happen only once in a while, Calvin came tromping down the gravel driveway, making as much noise as any human possibly could.
"Uncle Jim, are you around here somewhere? I parked the car where you told me."
He stumbled over an uneven spot in the road.
And why can't we use flashlights again?
Because we want to break our necks.
That last was said quietly. I'm not sure he intended anyone else to hear.
Not all of us, said Jim unnecessarily. Where are you? Calvin asked.
He couldn't see us, though we were no more than 40 feet away, and the half-gone moon lit the night. I tried to imagine what it would be like to wander around the night half-blind to everything around you. Vulnerable. No wonder people look for monsters in the dark.
We're over here, Jim said,
and Calvin changed his trajectory. About half the way over, he saw us. I could see it in his body. Evidently his uncle could, too.
The Hauptmans are already here. Hank and Fred are waiting in the monument.
Calvin increased his pace.
Everyone is early. Do we have to wait until midnight? We'll see. The earth is rich tonight, Jim said, waiting for us.
Nature abhors a vacuum, I said. Why aren't there nasty things out here sucking up this magic?
Because it is ours, said Calvin. Shamanistic. Not accessible to witch, wizard, or fae?
Asked Adam in fascinated tones.
I've heard about this kind of place, but never with any detail. I assumed they'd be hidden places. Not accessible to other kinds of magic users without a lot of work, said Jim. And more time than they are allowed. This is a pretty public place. My grandfather cleaned out a coven, burned the whole town to do it, and Maryhill never recovered. But they haven't tried again. I'm not sure that the Fae can't access it, but if they do, they probably can find a place nearby that is more private and almost as powerful. Ley lines are lines. They don't just stop in one place. From what I've heard, a wizard wouldn't hurt anything, but I've not seen one here.
The power was here before Stonehenge, said Calvin, but the construct seems to make it more accessible. There are a couple of places near here that were more traditional places of power, and probably were better before Sam Hill built this here.
Did Coyote tell you what he wanted you to do with all this magic? I asked.
Coyote? Asked Calvin. Who is Coyote?
Coyote, said Jim dryly.
Calvin smiled uncertainly, blinked a couple of times, then seemed to get it.
Coyote?
Then he looked at me.
She knows Coyote.
He broke off mid-word, staring at me.
Damn, he said in awe. Oh, hot damn. Watch your mouth, boy, Jim said. Freakin'
Calvin bit off the last word.
That's why you are a walker when your mother is white. Coyote is your freakin' father.
I don't know why his reaction offended me. No, I have it on the best of authority that Coyote is not my father. My father was a Blackfeet bull rider who died in a car wreck before I was born. I wasn't completely sure that Coyote wasn't my father, but I knew that he didn't think so, and I wasn't claiming him if he wasn't claiming me. Calvin frowned at me.
I am not, I said clearly, if through my clenched teeth, Coyote's daughter.
Jim took a deep breath.
Glad that's cleared up. Yes, Coyote told me what he wanted me to do. It's all set up inside the circle. Let's go see it then, Adam said.
He took Calvin by the arm and said,
Follow me. I'll keep you on your feet.
We walked past the Heelstone, a 16-foot-tall monolith just a little northeast of the rest of the monument, and under the continuous ring of cement-formed stone that was the outer edge of the henge. I looked up warily when we walked underneath the cement slab where both hawks were perched. They were about 15 feet over our heads, and my inner coyote was sure that wasn't far enough away. We were loud, too. The fine textured gravel wasn't conducive to quietness.
Hawks hunt by day.
Adam's grip on Calvin had shifted upward until he just rested a hand on his shoulder, but he was talking to me.
As long as Hank doesn't have a gun, Wolf trumps Hawk at night.
One of the hawks screamed an insult back, and Adam smiled, an expression that was as full of challenge as the hawk's cry.
Any time, Hawk, he said. Any time.
He was still ticked off about being shot, I thought. Come to think of it, I wasn't too happy about that either.
Calvin and I came about an hour ago, Jim was saying, ignoring the pre-fight exchange, and set up what we needed with flashlights. Coyote was pretty firm about no visible modern technology for the ceremony.
He looked at Calvin, and I was sure he could see in the dark a lot better than his nephew.
Flashlights were mentioned particularly, but I'm an old man and a big believer in work smarter, not harder, so we came up with the truck.
Stonehenge consisted of the heel stone, a pair of concentric circles, the first the ring of lintel stones held up by standing stones, the second a ring of monoliths, maybe 8 or 9 feet tall, and an inner court. The inner court was shaped somewhat like a horseshoe, with the open end pointed northeast, at the heel stone, in fact. The outer rim of the horseshoe was delineated by 5 huge sets of stones, each made of 2 standing stones holding up a lintel stone. They always reminded me of those staples used in furniture building, with a small band and tall legs. There were 2 on each side of the horseshoe and 1 in the center. All of them are taller than the outer ring, and the center one was taller still. Inside these massive rock sculptures was another set of the monoliths, following the horseshoe pattern. On top of all of the monoliths, both in the inner court and the outer, were fat, clear glass containers that protected the fat, white, unlit candles inside of them. The candle wicks were mostly blackened, indicating that they'd been used before. In front of the tallest of the massive cement-pretending-to-be-rock staple-like things, there was an altar, 8 or 10 feet long by 3 feet wide and 2 feet high. A few feet in front of the altar, the wood for a small fire had been set on top of what looked like a circle of 2-inch-thick coarse gravel, much darker and coarser than the gravel already there. I bent down to touch it, and Jim spoke.
"Tomorrow morning, when we can see, we'll come clean up," he told me. "The gravel will make it easy to erase any sign of fire. We don't want to give anyone ideas and have a bunch of teenagers lighting fires up here at night. It will also make sure that the fire doesn't spread. Grass fires happen this time of year, but I don't want to be the one who is responsible for one."
Adam had climbed up on a monolith to take a closer look at the candles, a casual pull-up that hinted at the strength he kept in check. He dropped to the ground and dusted his hands.
"Hard to light from down here. We kept the stool I used to put them all up there."
Calvin had stayed near Adam, but kept taking surreptitious glances at me. Then he frowned.
"Mercy, is that a black eye?"
I reached up to touch it.
"She got into a fight in Walmart," Adam said.
Someone who didn't know him probably wouldn't hear the amusement in his voice.
"What? She was attacked in Walmart."
"You should see the other woman," I said. I noticed we were missing someone. "Where's Jim?" He'd been talking to me just a minute ago. I'd have thought that the noisy gravel would keep him from sneaking around. Apparently, I'd been wrong.
"He's gone to wash and change," Calvin said. "There's a little building over there, used to be a tourist shop, but it's been closed for a few years now. Jim is a key. I'd better start lighting the candles. It takes a while." "We can help."
Adam took a cigarette lighter out of his pocket. Adam didn't smoke, but he took being prepared to a whole new level.
"I only have one stool," Calvin apologized. "That's okay."
Adam moved behind me, grabbed my hips, and lifted me up over his head and onto his shoulders. "Hey," I said indignantly. It would have gone a little smoother if he warned me first. As it was, I had to scramble a bit for balance. He waited until I was steady, then patted me on the hip.
"I don't need a step stool,"
Adam said, walking over to one of the monoliths and handing up a lighter.
"I have a Mercy."
Even with the 3 of us working on it, lighting the candles took a long time. I'd never noticed how many of them there were before. More than 30, I thought. Maybe even 50 of them. When we were through, there was a Christmassy air provided by dozens of white candles. By happenstance or design, we met Calvin at the last standing stone right next to the altar. Adam set me on the ground while Calvin finished the last light. In the short time, the magic in the ground had grown, and it jumped at me like an eager flame when my feet hit the gravel. I staggered a bit, and Adam, probably thinking I was still off balance, put a hand on my shoulder to steady me. Calvin climbed off his step stool, put his lighter in his pocket, and folded up the stool.
"I'm going to take this over to the parking lot. Meanwhile, Uncle Jim asked me to tell you that you need to take the shape of your beasts."
"Do you know what Coyote has us doing?" I asked. Calvin dropped his eyes.
"No."
I snorted before he could say anything. "Don't bother. You are without a doubt the worst liar I have ever met. Good for you. But you might keep it in mind and compensate for it. Cultivate a mysterious air, and don't answer the things that might tempt you to lie. That was what Bran did. Even Bran couldn't lie to a werewolf. I didn't think he could, anyway.
How long do we have? Adam asked. Walkers may be able to flash between shapes, but I take more time.
I didn't know. Sorry. I should have told you before I started on the lights.
If they want us here, they'll wait for us, I told Adam.
Yeah, Calvin agreed. I'm pretty sure that this ceremony needs both of you.
He took a step away from us, then stopped.
Hey, Fred told me you were asking about the deaths on the Columbia. He asked me to check into it, so I asked a friend of mine who's a cop on the river. He told me that in the past 3 weeks there have been 26 people who are presumed drowned between the John Day Dam and the one at the Dalles, not including the family of four that was reported missing late this afternoon when their car was found at a state park on the Oregon side of the Columbia. That's more people than we've lost on the river in the last 5 years combined.
What family? I asked.
A stockbroker and his elementary teacher wife and their two young children, he told me.
Lee and Janice Morrison. The dream had been real. I could have done something about it. Surely I could have done something.
That's right. Did you see today's paper?
Adam's hand was on my shoulder.
How long have they been missing? He asked.
2 days.
Before my dream. I'd seen something that had happened in the past. No chance of doing anything. It should have made me feel better, but it didn't.
I think, said Adam softly, it is safe to say that this is something that needs to be hunted down and killed.
Calvin nodded.
Word is that there is an FBI team working on the idea that we have some sort of serial killer on the loose. They're being quiet so far. They don't want to encourage the killer or panic anyone. My buddy was pretty interested in why I was asking. I told him it was because of Benny and Faith.
He looked at me.
That way, I wasn't lying to him.
Let's go change, I said. I didn't want to think about Janice and her family anymore. They were gone, and there was nothing I could do for them. Had we been home with the wolf pack around, we'd just have stripped and changed, but I wasn't comfortable stripping in front of strangers anymore. Even if I'd been willing to, Adam would not change in public. Bran had requested the wolves refrain from changing where others could see. The werewolves were beautiful, but the change is horrific. No sense in scaring people with what they were, Bran said. Not when the wolves were still trying to be tame for the news cameras. So we left Stonehenge and climbed over the drop-off just beyond, which hid us effectively from Calvin, Hank, and Fred, as long as the hawk stayed on the far side of the henge. Still, we were exposed. There were no trees nearby, and we could see all the way down to the river and beyond to the highway, miles and miles. Darkness ensured that no one down there could actually see us, but it felt like they could. Beside Adam, who was doing the same thing, I took off my clothes, folding them tightly to discourage any bugs attracted by the leftover warmth. I stuffed my socks in my shoes. "I'll stay human until you've shifted," I told him, so I could guard his back or run interference if I had to. Shifting to coyote wasn't without its cost. I could do it several times a day, but eventually I wore out. I could also stay human for a long time, months if I had to. Wolves are different. Werewolves are moon-called. They have to change during the full moon, and it is harder for them to control the wolf during that time, too. However, a lot of werewolves only shift during the full moon, 2 or 3 days a month. The shift is painful and takes a lot of energy. Shifting more than a couple of times a week was beyond a lot of wolves' abilities. Adam had been changing much more than that lately. His shift was a lot slower than usual, and it looked as though it was a lot more painful, too. I sat beside him on the pad my folded-up clothes made. Maybe I should have left my clothes on, but since tonight, at least, I wasn't wet, it wasn't cold. I stayed close to him, but not so close I'd touch him inadvertently and hurt him. The pulse of Stonehenge's magic was growing more regular, like a beating heart. I thought it was getting even stronger, too, but that might have been because I was sitting on the ground. My own heart sped up a little until it kept beat with the magic. It wasn't unpleasant, just disconcerting.
"Mercy," Calvin called.
"Not yet," I told him.
"How long?" As long as it takes,
growled Adam, his voice hoarse and deep as he was caught halfway between wolf and man. The flow of magic paused, as if it had hurt him, then took up its beat again. I didn't like it. Are you all right? I asked very quietly. He didn't say anything, which I took as answer enough. His breathing grew labored until I started to be seriously worried for him.
It's the Earth's magic, Coyote said, sitting down beside me on the side opposite Adam's struggle.
Adam growled, a hoarse and pained sound that was nonetheless a threat.
No harm to you or yours, Coyote told him. I stand guard for you. They were supposed to tell you to change before you came here. I suppose the instructions got garbled in the translation from Jim to Calvin. Mother Earth does not change easily. That is an aspect of water or flame. Earth magic is interfering with his change, but it shouldn't make it impossible.
Impossible wasn't good, but I buttoned my lips, because even I knew that intent and will played a part in any kind of magic. No sense putting doubts into Adam's head until he really failed to shift. What are we doing tonight? I asked Coyote, to give myself something else to think about.
Probably wasting our time.
He didn't look at me, but stared out over the world spread beneath our feet. I noticed that he seldom spoke directly to me. Half the time, it felt as though he addressed the open air instead. And if we aren't wasting our time? I waited a minute, trying not to listen to Adam's struggles because he wouldn't want me to hear him. I could feel the claustrophobic panic that he was repressing. He couldn't afford for me to panic, too. Come on, Coyote. It isn't a secret because even Calvin knows. He laughed, slapping his leg.
Point to you. Fine, fine. I'm hoping to call a little help. We aren't what we once were, and some of us never were much for interfering with people. But Raven is curious, and Otter should feel he has something at stake.
He paused, glanced at me, and continued.
Nice black eye, Mercy.
Upon reflection, Otter might be on the wrong side. That would be unfortunate.
You're calling the others like you? I asked.
There are no others like me, he returned. None as handsome or strong, none as clever or skilled, none with so many stories told about them. Who was it brought fire down so people could roast their food and keep warm in the winter? But I'm hoping to call the others, yes.
Other what, exactly? I asked. Just what kind of creature are you? The Fae, some of them, had set themselves over the early residents of Europe as deities. The Coyote stories never had that feel to them. Coyote was a power, but not one who asked to be worshipped.
Have you read Plato? He asked.
Have you? I returned, because the idea of Coyote reading the Republic or Apology was absurd, and somehow totally believable because of its very absurdity.
You are familiar with his theory of forms, Coyote continued without answering my question.
That our world isn't real, but a reflection of reality. And in the real world, there are archetypes of things that exist in our world, which is how we can look at a chair we've never seen before and say, hey, look, it's a chair. Because in the real world, there is an object that is the epitome of chairness. I used my history degree about twice a year, whether I needed to or not.
Close enough, he agreed. I am the reality of all coyotes. The archetype. The epitome.
He smiled out into the darkness.
You are just a reflection of me.
They should have called you Narcissus, I told him, trying not to flinch at the sounds that Adam made. Too bad you aren't the enemy we need to defeat. We could just put out a mirror for you to admire yourself in.
And then they wouldn't call you Mercy anymore, he said. Your name would be She Who Traps Coyote.
He reached over and took my hand and said in a low voice,
it won't be much longer, but I'd wait until he invites you to look before you gaze into his eyes.
Are your sisters really berries in your stomach? I asked him.
Ah, he said delightedly. You need to find someone to teach you the rude versions of my stories. They are much more entertaining. Modesty prevents me from telling stories about myself.
I laughed as he meant me to.
My sisters aren't speaking to me right now, he finished with great, and I suspected entirely feigned, dignity. So it does not matter what they are.
Beside me, Adam rose with a snarl. I lowered my head to show that I was no threat. After a bad change, it would be a few minutes before Adam had a leash on his wolf. To my surprise, Coyote bowed his head as well.
I like this man, your husband, he told me.
Maybe it was an explanation.
He would have attacked me for putting you in danger, even though the wolf knew exactly what I was. And yet, when you asked him to have patience, he did. It is proper that men listen to the counsel of women.
Like you listen to your sisters, I said, as the wolf put his nose just under my ear. I tilted my head to give him my throat. Sharp teeth brushed against my skin, and I shivered.
Wise women, Coyote agreed, but sometimes pushy and easy to rile. I think they need to develop their sense of fun. They do not agree with me. So maybe they are not so wise as all that, eh?
Adam shook himself hard, his ears making a flapping sound, a signal. I turned to look at him, and he jerked his nose up toward the monument. I changed into my coyote self, which did seem to take a little more effort than it normally did, and followed Adam up the hill, Coyote striding beside us. At least he wasn't Baba Yaga or Yo-Yo Girl, I thought. Gordon was talking quietly with Calvin and Jim when we walked into the Henges' circles. Jim was barefoot, dressed in new dark jeans and a long-sleeved shirt that looked to be blue in the light of the candles, though my coyote eyes are not always trustworthy with color at night. Gordon's boots, for instance, looked black, but I thought they were probably the same red boots he'd worn the rest of the times we'd seen him. He wore a flannel shirt over a plain T-shirt.
I was beginning to think that it was time to leave, said Gordon coolly as we approached. Earth magic isn't the best thing for a change when you're a werewolf, Coyote said, which is why I told Jim to make sure he was a wolf when he got here. You said to tell Mercy to bring the wolf, Jim said, sounding irritated.
I was beginning to think that everyone sounded like that after a while of dealing with Coyote. Calvin's eyes widened, and he looked as though he expected Jim to get hit by lightning. Coyote just laughed.
Mercy, you go sit up on the altar, would you?
He looked up at the hawks.
You too, go sit next to her.
Gordon didn't seem awed or surprised by Coyote either.
Whatever you do in front of Hank, the river devil will see. Let her watch, Coyote said indifferently. But if nothing else happens tonight, I think I can get Hank fixed. Hank owes me a few favors.
I hopped up onto the altar next to the hawks, a little hesitantly. There was a bronze plaque on top, but it was too worn to read in the dark. Adam hopped up beside me and curled around me protectively, keeping the bulk of his body between me and the other predators.
Adam, said Coyote, not being Aztec, we are not going to sacrifice your bride on the altar. She just can't be touching the ground when Jim performs the dance. However, should Wolf answer this call, it would be disastrous if your head were higher than his. Usually he shows up in human or human-like form, but he is one who often prefers his wolf skin. Would you mind taking a position just in front of the altar, between it and the fire?
Adam snarled soundlessly at the hawks, a clear warning, and slipped off the altar to sit where Coyote had asked him to. Gordon's eyebrows had risen almost to his white hair.
A polite coyote?
Coyote growled something in a foreign language.
I thought you were not her father, Gordon said placidly. That makes him not your son by marriage. Say then, said Coyote. I respect him and don't fancy getting in the middle of a dogfight tonight if I can help it. Now let us get this done.
He changed. His shift was even faster than mine, I thought, though I couldn't be sure. Between one blink and the next, there was a huge coyote the size of a Saint Bernard. He stalked over to the monolith that was on one end of the horseshoe and hopped up on top of it. Gordon looked sour. Then he became the largest eagle I have ever seen in my life, and I've seen some huge golden eagles. As a bird, he stood taller than the man he'd been. I couldn't say what color his feathers were, though they looked as if they were several shades darker than the hawk's. Then he spread his wings, and I realized Gordon wasn't an eagle, after all. No eagle ever had a wingspan that large.
"Thunderbird," said Calvin reverently. "Grandfather said you were Thunderbird, but that was when he was calling me by my father's name more often than not."
Thunderbird. The bird leaned forward and rubbed that wicked, sharp-looking beak against the side of Calvin's head. Since Calvin's head stayed on his shoulders, I had to assume it was a gesture of affection. With a movement that was half hop and half flight, he landed on the monolith opposite Coyote. He made the standing stone look a lot smaller. Gordon, who was Thunderbird, nudged the candle until it was situated where he wanted. The candlelight turned his feathers a warm, dark chocolate. He rocked back and forth a bit, stretching his wings out, then settled into stillness. Calvin brought out a rolled-up rug, a small drum, and a beaded parflesh bag. Parflesh, untanned hide, was more commonly used by the Plains Indians than the Plateau Indians like the Yakima, I thought. However, I supposed a medicine man could use whatever implements he wanted to. Calvin set the bag to one side of the prepared but as yet unlit fire. Then, with great formality, he unrolled the carpet, aligning it with the altar stone. He took the drum with him to sit next to Adam. Jim stood in front of the carpet and closed his eyes. It looked like a prayer, but whatever he did caused the magic to sit up and take notice. I could feel it even through the cement I perched upon. He stepped onto the carpet and held a hand over the stacked wood.
"Wood," he said, "who swallowed the flame of the fire beings. It is time to burn."
When the little fire burst into flame, Adam flinched a bit, but it didn't seem to surprise Calvin or Jim. Jim gave a small nod to Calvin, who began to play the drum. At first he played with a simple, one-handed beat. It wasn't a steady sound, but tentative and irregular, until he caught the beat of the magic that ran beneath us. He stayed with that for a while, then began to speed up, accenting the simple beat with grace notes. When the magic followed his additions, he switched up the cadence to a driving, syncopated rhythm, and the magic followed his lead. The wind chose that moment to pick up and throw smoke from the fire into my eyes. I blinked, but I must have gotten some ash in with the smoke. Putting my muzzle down on top of the stone, I scrubbed at my face with my paws. It helped. I lifted my head as soon as I could see, and I was alone. Chapter 11. I stood up in a panic, the beat of Calvin's drum still strong, but the bond between Adam and me was strong and reassuring. It gave me courage to stay where I was, take a deep breath, and look around to see if I could figure out what had happened to everyone else. The fire burned, the candles were lit, and the night sky overhead was clear and star-spangled. However, there was a thick fog at ground level, and I could see nothing beyond the outer ring of the henge. About that time I realized that I was in my human shape, wearing the clothes I'd taken off and carefully folded a little while ago. They felt real under my fingers, even the slight roughness where I'd dripped a little mustard on my jeans that afternoon. But I was pretty sure this was a vision. I couldn't think of any other reason that I could still hear the drum. The rising hair on the back of my neck told me that somewhere someone was watching me. I couldn't hear or smell them, but I could feel eyes on me. Maybe they were waiting for an invitation. "Hello?"
"Hello, Mercedes."
I turned around and found that there were four women walking in through the largest of the staple-shaped rocks. All of them were dressed in identical white doe-skin wedding dresses complete with fringe and elk teeth. Their feet were bare and calloused, and the pale dust from the light gray gravel covered their feet as if they had been walking in it a long time. They smelled clean and astringent like sage or witch hazel, but sweeter than either. I was no expert on native peoples, despite a bit of heritage searching while I was in college, but I was sufficiently well-versed to know that each of them was from a very different tribe, despite their too-beautiful-to-be-real features. The first woman looked Navajo or Hopi to me, or maybe even Apache. Her skin was darker than any of the others, and her features were soft. She wore her hair in Princess Leia-like buns on either side of her head, which I thought was a traditional Hopi style, the style of one of the Pueblo Indians anyway. The second woman had the rounded, low cheekbones of the Inuit, and her eyes crinkled at me in a friendly fashion. Her hair was separated into two thick braids that hung down to her shoulders. The third woman looked like someone from one of the Plains tribes, though I couldn't pinpoint exactly what made me think so. Her face was a little less soft than the first two, her gaze clear and penetrating. Like the second woman, she wore her hair in a pair of braids, but hers hung down past her waist. She had bone earrings in her ears, the only one of the four to wear jewelry of any kind. The fourth woman wore her dark hair pulled loosely back from her face, but otherwise it was free to flow halfway down her back. It was thick and wiry, like the mane of a wild horse. I could not tell what people she was from, except that she was Indian. Her features were sharp, her nose narrow, and her lips full. She was the one who spoke first.
"Mercedes is not a proper Indian name."
Her tone, like her words, was critical, but not emotionally so. I'd have expected to hear such a tone from a woman in a market looking at fruit. She pursed her lips briefly, evidently considering my name.
"She is a mechanic. We should call her She Fixes Cars."
The first woman, the one who might have been Hopi, shook her head.
"No, sister. Bringer of change."
The woman who looked like one of the Plains Indians, but not quite Crow, Blackfeet, or Lakota, frowned disapprovingly.
"Rash coyote who runs with wolf. We could shorten it to dinner woman."
The merry Inuit woman laughed.
"Mercedes who fixes Volkswagens, we have brought you to see us, since our brother would not bring us to see you."
"Your brother?" I asked carefully. I was still standing on the altar, which had me looking down on them. That felt wrong, so I stepped off onto the sand, and the magic in the ground promptly turned my knees to rubber.
"Coyote," they said at the same time, while the Inuit woman kept me from falling.
I couldn't help but think that it would be a bad thing to sit on the ground if just standing on it had this much of an effect. I sat on the altar and pulled my feet up.
"We cannot tell the future," said the sharp-featured woman whose tribe I couldn't place at all. "But we know what our brother is planning. Would you tell him that it is very dangerous, but it is also the only thing that we could think of that might work?"
"What is he planning?" I asked.
"We can tell you here."
Inuit woman sat beside me, but left her feet on the ground.
"But he can't tell you until he rids himself of her spies. That's actually why we brought you here. That, and we wanted to get a look at you. He sees spirits, you know him as Jim Alvin, has opened this way between us for a short time."
Coyote needed privacy to speak to the others, to Hawk and Raven, to Bear and Beaver, and to the rest. "We decided that you should know what he says."
"River Devil," said the Hopi Navajo, possibly Apache woman, "is a creature who lives in your world and ours at the same time. In ours, she is immortal, but she can be killed in yours. Once she is dead, she cannot go back unless she is summoned. But at that time, she returns bigger and more dangerous than before. The last time our brother confronted her, he trapped her rather than killing her, in the hope that it would be more effective than killing her had proved."
I decided she was Hopi, and as I did so, her features changed just a little until there was no possibility of her being anything else.
"Who would summon that thing?" I asked.
The Inuit woman shrugged.
"There will always be fools, and the river devil can be persuasive to the minds of men."
The sharp-featured woman.
"Cherokee," I said, suddenly certain I had it right.
She smiled a small, secret smile,
the kind that always makes me want to smack Bran.
If you like.
She tilted her head and said, River Devil is hunger, because living between worlds for those without a hold in either is costly. She must consume food for both her aspects, meat for the flesh and for the spirit. The Hopi woman continued, All life is rife with possibilities. Seeds have possibilities, but all their tomorrows are cut by the patterning of their life cycle. Animals have possibilities that are greater than that of a fir tree or a blade of grass. Still, though, for most animals, the pattern of instinct, the patterns of their lives, are very strong. Humanity has a far greater range of possibilities, especially the very young. Who will children grow up to be? Who will they marry? What will they believe? What will they create? Creation is a very powerful seed of possibility. The plainswoman, who was not Lakota, Crow, or Blackfeet, said, River Devil feeds on possibilities. Inuit woman reached up to place her hand on her sister's shoulder.
She feeds on the death of those possibilities. For this reason, she must feed upon people rather than animals, animals rather than plants. But best of all, she loves to feed upon children.
She feeds on the end of possibilities, corrected the plainswoman. Shoshone, I decided. She looked Shoshone to me. She smiled as if she'd heard me think it aloud. It was a big smile, like her brother's.
The greater the possibilities, the better her hunger is sated. When she is full, she must digest her prey both here in the world of spirits and also there in the world of flesh. While she is doing that, she is vulnerable.
Coyote and his kind, hawk, bear, salmon, wolf, thunderbird, and others, they have more possibilities than even a newborn child. The Cherokee woman turned in a graceful circle, as if to encompass all that Coyote and those like him were. If Coyote can persuade enough of them to allow River Devil to consume them, they may be enough to force the River Devil to overeat, and she will be helpless until she digests them all.
While she is helpless, someone needs to kill her.
The Inuit sister looked at me with her big dark eyes, and I knew with a sinking feeling who they were talking about.
What about Fred or Hank? I asked.
Adam couldn't do it. His strength might make him a better candidate, but werewolves don't swim. I wouldn't risk Adam to the river.
They are vulnerable to the River Devil's mark, she said.
Then she paused and addressed my unvoiced thought.
I do not know about the werewolf. Alone, he would be like the others, but his pack might keep him safe.
Or she might gain the whole pack.
The Hopi woman shook her head.
No, that would not be wise, nor is water the werewolf's element, for all that it is an element of change.
Shoshone woman said, She must die, then. As she eats, she grows in power. If she does not die before she digests such a meal as our brother will provide, she will be much, much more destructive than she is now.
What about an airstrike, I said, or nuclear weapons? I know people who might be able to get the military in on this.
Bran could. He might not be out, but he knew how to get things done when he wanted to.
Hopi woman shook her head. No, modern weapons will not harm her. Only the most simple thing, a symbol of the earth that opposes her water, a stone knife.
Our time is short now, Cherokee woman said. You must go back.
Shoshone woman touched my cheek. Tell our brother he is wise. That we have no further words of wisdom to add to his.
He says that you are not speaking to him, I said.
She laughed, but it was a sad laugh.
Coyote doesn't usually lie, but sometimes he forgets. It is he who is angry with us. We gave him advice he did not like, and he got mad.
Cherokee woman narrowed her eyes at me.
We told him nothing good could come of letting Joe Old Coyote take the Anglo woman to his bed.
Inuit woman smiled and touched my leg.
Obviously, we were wrong.
Coyote is like the River Devil, I said, right? He walks in both places. So why doesn't he eat everything in sight?
Coyote walks in one world at a time, Cherokee woman told me. He can do this without being trapped, because we wait for him here, and you and his other descendants anchor him there.
Coyote understands that the universe is all one, Shoshone woman's voice was indulgent.
Coyote, said Hopi woman dryly, doesn't much worry about understanding anything, which is why he understands so much.
What happens when the river devil eats them, Coyote and the others?
In the stories, Coyote died and was reborn the next day. But there was an air of resignation that clung to these women that hinted at something more dire this time. They exchanged looks that I could not read.
We don't know.
Inuit woman stared out into the fog that surrounded us.
As I told you, it is not given to us to know the future. We are merely wise advisers.
It may be that this is the last time for Coyote to walk your world, said Cherokee woman in a low voice. So much has changed. It is impossible to know what those changes mean.
There are some who do not walk either world any longer.
Shoshone woman's eyes glistened with tears.
River Devil is of both worlds, and so could send them back scattered into the universe.
Do not worry about that which cannot be changed. Hopi woman sat on the ground and patted my tennis shoes.
Even if Coyote is not reborn with the morning sun, there is always hope of a new dawn. Come now, sisters. It is time to send her back.
I think she looks like me, said Shoshone woman. What do you think?
And her words still rang in my ears when I found myself back where I had started. Time had passed. I could tell because Jim was kneeling on the rug feeding tobacco leaves into the fire. He sang, the words unintelligible to my ears, but not foreign. Adam licked my nose, then nipped it. He'd noticed I was gone then. I'd ask him later if my body had disappeared with me, or if it had just waited there for me. I nuzzled him to let him know I was fine. One of the hawks, Fred and Hank were hard to tell apart when they were human, as hawks I figured I might have a 50-50 chance, fluttered his wings and cried out softly. We were apparently bothering him. Adam hopped up on the altar where I was sitting and stepped over me with his front paws. He lowered his head and showed the hawk his teeth. Both hawks retreated to the far edge of the altar because neither was stupid, and maybe because Adam had great big teeth. I glanced first at Jim, who seemed to be very focused on his song and on feeding the last of the tobacco leaves into the fire, then out at Coyote and Gordon, who were gone. Adam licked my ear, then lay down between me and the hawks. His front paws hung down over the front of the altar, and I suspected his back paws were off on the other end. The 3 feet of cement that was the width of the altar was generous for me, but wasn't nearly enough to hold a whole werewolf. Jim closed his eyes and held up his right hand. When he closed his fist, the drumbeat stopped, and with it, the overwhelming pulse of magic. It was like someone had pulled the plug at a nightclub, and all the music stopped. As suddenly as if someone had slammed a door, Stonehenge was as mundane as an exact model of a Neolithic calendar could be. No magic, no mystery, just a gray cement monument that suddenly had a lot more people in it than there had been when the drum had been sounding. Gordon and Coyote in their human guises were standing in front of the monoliths they'd started out on top of. Between us and them, 6 Indian men I'd never seen before stepped away from the monoliths. One man, who looked no older than Calvin, was in a 3-piece suit. Adam had taught me to recognize good suits, and this one was several thousand dollars of very nice. Another, like Gordon, was wearing a modern cowboy look, though his was toned down a fair bit. Brown boots, jeans, earth-tone striped shirt, and a brown Montana-style, narrow-brimmed cowboy hat. Iron-gray hair was braided tightly and fell over his shoulder and almost to his knees. The other 4 wore traditional native garb, though unlike Coyote's sisters, no 2 of them were dressed alike. There were 2 in hunting leathers of slightly different styles. The older one, whose wrinkled face and white hair made Gordon look like a young man, wore leathers that were nearly as pale as the doeskin Coyote's sisters had worn. Except for the fringe around the shoulder seams, his leathers were very plain. The other man's hunting leathers were a rich dark brown, with ornate quillwork around his neckline. There were stains on his clothes, as if he'd gone hunting many times wearing that particular shirt and leggings. The third man in native dress wore leather leggings, but his loose shirt was made of patterned red gingham and tied with a hemp belt that ended in a fringe to which tiny brass bells were tied. His hair was cut straight around his jawline. The fourth had a red cloth wrapped around his head, almost like a turban, from which maybe a dozen brownish-red feathers stuck straight up. He wore a beaded breech clout that reached his knees in front and back. His shirt was a striped cotton that looked to have been loomed by hand rather than machine from the slight irregularity of the weave. I got a really good look at his shirt, because he walked right up to the altar and grabbed the hawk nearest me, one hand confining the wicked talons. He pulled the bird hard against his body, trapping the wings with his arm and the sharp beak with his hand.
"So," he said, his voice heavily accented, "she tries to steal my hawk's will." "As I told you, Hawk," said Coyote, "can you fix it?"
The man holding the bird gave Coyote a cold stare, with eyes as sharp as those of the animal who took his name. The hawk left behind made a soft noise, like a baby bird in the nest.
"I do not approve of you, Coyote. You have always been more concerned with the two-legged people than the people in fur."
"I was asked to help. Would you have refused the request of the Great Spirit?" Hawk snorted.
"You were doing it before that, and look what has happened."
He let go of the hawk's talons to make a sweeping gesture. It didn't matter, because Hank was limp in his grasp.
"There are cars and roads, bridges and houses until the earth cannot breathe. It would have been better had the Great Spirit stopped with the first people."
Coyote sneered just a little.
"As I'm sure you would tell him."
"I'm telling you," said Hawk.
He reached down and grabbed a handful of dirt and small gravel. He tossed it into the air, and the wind caught it, held it. He held the bird up over his head, and the wind blew the handful of earth through the hawk, who cried out when it hit him. He threw the bird up in the air, gave Coyote another cold look, and disappeared. The bird dropped, and Hank landed in a naked human heap on the ground. Naked meant that it was easy to see that the mark was gone. Beside me, Fred, also in human skin, scrambled off the altar and over to his brother. Jim, now seated on the rug and looking exhausted but fascinated, motioned to his apprentice, and Calvin took off at a run, presumably for clothes, but I wasn't certain.
"Hawk is impetuous," said the man in the suit, "and I don't like agreeing with him."
His casual gaze traveled around Stonehenge in mild curiosity. It passed over Adam and me, then returned. Pale blue eyes that looked wrong and somehow utterly right in that oh-so-Native American face focused on Adam. "Ah," he said, striding over in the same no-nonsense ground-covering way that Adam used to cross a crowded room.
"This is the werewolf."
Adam got slowly to his feet and shook himself lightly. As he stood on top of the altar, his head was level with the collarbone of the suited man, who could only be Wolf.
"I had heard of your kind," Wolf said.
I glanced at the other men there, but they seemed to be happy to let Wolf take center stage as Hawk had done a moment ago.
"Werewolf,"
Wolf frowned.
"I had thought it an abomination when I heard it first. Wolf, trapped in the same skin as a human, always in opposition with each other. And in some ways, it is abominable. But look at you. You are beautiful."
I thought so, too.
"How is that different from our walkers?" asked Coyote in an interested tone. "They carry both spirits, too."
"No," said Wolf absently, still lost in his examination of Adam.
"In our descendants, there is only one spirit that expresses itself as either human or animal. This is different. The wolf is mine, and the man, not at all. And yet it works."
He touched Adam, and I felt it through our bond, felt Adam's wolf come forward to meet Wolf. Adam was wary, but not alarmed, neither dominant nor dominated. Wolf's hands traveled all over Adam's head and neck, like a judge at a dog show. Adam showed no sign that it bothered him, though it bothered me. Adam was mine.
"The perfect predator," Wolf purred,
leaning forward and rubbing his cheek possessively against Adam's cheek. I may have let out a disgruntled yip. Wolf glanced over at me with cool blue eyes, and his mouth curled up in the beginnings of a snarl.
"That one is mine," said Coyote.
His tone was casual, but there was steel behind it that turned the simple comment into a warning. Wolf looked at Coyote and reached out to swat me with the back of his hand, and Adam caught that hand in his